Back together again, you and I chatting it up and wrapping up a busy week. Friday, the 20th of September, 2024 on Connecticut Today. I open the show wondering what, if anything, can really be done to prevent student-generated school threats, or is that just out of our hands? Author, columnist, and historian Max Boot stopped by to talk about his new book, getting rave reviews, Reagan, His Life and Legend. So the disruptions continue today for Bridgeport area schools. Of course, early dismissal yesterday, no classes today, as we continue to grapple with this that's not only going on in Bridgeport, as many stories, you know, point out today, including Natasha Sokoloff's story here in the Connecticut Post. There have been threats in Bridgeport, Middletown, Westport, Fairfield on Thursday alone. So again, interesting story that she wrote here about the angle of how this stresses out kids. And obviously there is, you know, an angle to this. I mean, can you imagine being a kid? And we heard from callers, you know, yesterday who were saying, hey, they're hearing from their relatives, their sons, their daughters that, you know, work in the school system and all this, that, you know, the kids are getting stressed out. They don't know what to do. There are threats all over. I heard from somebody who got in contact with me a few days ago who does have some experience in a Connecticut school system. Not going to tell you who or where, but, you know, I've heard from actually a couple of people that say this doesn't, you know, the threats don't always make it to the radio stations like us, or the TV stations, or the newspapers, or the online stuff. So here's the big question. What do you do? And again, in this story I'm reading here in Hearst, and there are stories in The Current about it, and the Republican American, and all the other fine newspapers around the state and online publications. You know, you're getting, you're hearing what you would expect, that the administrators are stressed out. The staff members are stressed out. The kids are showing, you know, some signs already, even at a young age, of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. But there's an elephant in the room that nobody will address. And maybe it's because the elephant's in control now, or the horse is out of the barn, or however you want to say that. Is there no going back on this? Because remember, as we said yesterday, a lot of you folks, I wasn't surprised, you know, that you agreed with me. And it's not because I'm so darn smart, but we were all kids at one time. And you have a scenario here where you get so angry that for a split second, and then it probably wears off as you lay on the grass and stare up at the clouds or the stars, depending upon what time it is. You say to yourself, all right, maybe I don't want to, you know, rip the hair out of everybody I know. Maybe it's all right, I'm going to go home and have dinner. But I don't know how you fix this. How do you fix this? Is this fixable? Or is this just another thing we have to deal with? And, you know, when talk hosts like myself and politicians like J.D. Vance said it, you know, a few days ago, hey, this, unfortunately, whether it's because of guns or social media or what have you, you know, this is just the reality now. So are we into now the sad reality of these school threats, which can be made online, which can be made in text messages, which can be made rather quietly and slyly because of all the social media channels out there? Is this just something we have to deal with? And I hate hearing that. Honestly, I do. I hate hearing that it's something we have to deal with. But now, as people are getting into teaching in a profession that we all love and know, we all have teachers, most of us, you know, in our families, among our circles of friends, people we went to high school with, people we went to college with, whatever. Is this something now that they have to consider, too? Yeah, you know, they consider the pay, they consider the district, they consider, you know, what grade they're teaching. Is it now that you have to consider, well, how am I going to handle a threat? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And again, you have to realize part of this is social media. When you and I were growing up, we didn't have to. We didn't have the mode, the ability to do this. So who's to say that next week, or the week after, or 2 weeks after that, that we aren't going to hear these threats again, and it'll disrupt teachers and students and parents and administrators and paraprofessionals. Now, thankfully, with technology, we can find these people. And again, you don't like to see young people get arrested here. But honestly, I don't think there's anything we can do. Now, again, you can offer counseling. You can offer, peer services to, the students who say, hey, I'm freaked out. I don't want to go to school. You can do that and offer counseling and peer services to maybe some teachers, some administrators, some paraprofessionals in the schools. But honestly, how do you stop this? How do you stop a kid or kids or whatever when years ago they would place a crank call to the schools, or maybe leave a note there that, would be, after a while, would be tossed aside as an empty threat? But now it can be done with a click of a phone, with a click of a mouse. And again, I commend these news outlets and people saying, it's causing this and it's causing that. Well, obviously it is. And we have to watch for the mental health of our students, our teachers, our paraprofessionals, our parents. But can you really stop it? It's like gun violence. I guess what you can do is harden the targets at schools and make sure there are school resource officers, in these schools. But, that seems almost on some level simple when you ask yourself and compare it to the fact of, wait a minute, how do I stop these threats when they have the avenues, the boulevards of being able to make themselves known on social media, which can get something not just you screaming out your window, but around the world in a millisecond. What do you think of this? Is this just something that, as we look at each other and settle in on a Friday heading into the weekend, you just worry about and pray to God and cross your fingers? Doesn't happen. Our next guest, a well-known historian and foreign policy analyst, the Gene J. Kirkpatrick Senior Fellow for National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Well-known columnist. You've probably read him in the Washington Post. His New York Times bestseller, The Road Not Taken, a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize for a biography, graduate of Cal Berkeley and Yale. The new book, Reagan, His Life and Legend, Max Boot, joins us. Max, it's Paul here in Bridgeport, Connecticut. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Max, so many things have been written by Ronald Reagan, and I really came of age politically watching and being fascinated by Mr. Reagan. But so I have to ask you, the obvious question that came to mind here, why do this? Were there things that you didn't think were covered in previous works about Mr. Reagan?
Well, there have been a lot of books written about Ronald Reagan, but when I started this book more than 10 years ago, there was still not a definitive and comprehensive biography that really gave you an objective overview of his life and presidency. And that's something that I set out to change. I wanted to write neither a hagiography nor a hit job, but something that gives a very fair and balanced treatment of Reagan, showing both his strengths and his weaknesses, his successes as well as his failures. And I was very cheered to see just a few days ago the New Yorker ran a review that said Reagan, His Life and Legend, aims to be the definitive biography, and it succeeds. So I felt like that was kind of a mission accomplished moment.
Yeah, the kudos, Max, that this book is getting. You know it's good when you're getting praise from both the left and the right, right? I guess you're getting some bipartisan
Absolutely.
Praise on this, right?
Absolutely, and it's also made the New York Times bestseller list, so nice to see that readers are picking it up.
Ronald Reagan always, Max, to me, I watched him incessantly in doing a show like this. I'm always reading stuff about him. As substantive as he was, Max Boot, and here's a guy who won two landslide elections. Did you go into this with kind of the same notion that's already said, that there was kind of a part of Reagan that people either didn't know or didn't understand, or he didn't reveal to us? Was there still kind of a mystery to this guy?
Absolutely. There is an enduring mystery, and that's one of the many paradoxes of Ronald Reagan, because if you just knew Reagan from watching your TV screens, you saw this very genial, amiable, friendly, you know, kind of your lovable neighbor next door type. And he seemed like the most open and gregarious of souls. But people who really knew him and were close to him told me that there was actually kind of a chilliness at his core, and he was actually very remote and hard to know. And even Nancy Reagan herself said that there was a part of him that was walled off even from her. And that's something that I traced back to his very difficult childhood in small town Illinois. You know, his father, Jack, was an alcoholic shoe salesman and kept losing one job after another. And so the family kept moving from town to town. And so little Dutch Reagan, as he was then called, never really stayed in one place long enough to get close to the other kids. And so he always created this kind of distance between himself and everybody else and erected this kind of mental fence around himself that lasted for the rest of his life.
The name of the book is Reagan, His Life and Legend. We're talking to author Max Boot. Max, was there one or two things you found physically or in a reference or one or two people that you interviewed for this that gave you maybe an oh wow moment about Mr. Reagan?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were a lot of fascinating documents and a lot of fascinating people to talk to. And actually, I found that although I talked to a lot of famous people like the George Shultz, Colin Powell, James Baker, and many others, Ed Meese, I actually found the most interesting interviews to be with the people who are much less famous. For example, a fellow named Dennis LeBlanc, who was one of the California state policemen who protected Reagan when he was governor of California. And then he basically became a ranch hand working with Reagan on his ranch near Santa Barbara. And it turns out that Dennis LeBlanc and another former cop named Barney Barnett, who also worked on the ranch, those guys were actually Reagan's closest friends by the 1980s outside of Nancy. Those were the guys he really enjoyed hanging out with. They would do chores together. You know, they would chop firewood and clear brush and do all this other stuff. And those were the people he spent the most quality time with. And they would all, you know, kind of have dinner together in the ranch house and then collapse in front of the TV watching Murder, She Wrote or something like that. what I found out was that those guys that nobody's ever heard of, Dennis LeBlanc and Barney Barnett, those were really Reagan's closest friends in the 1980s, much more so than all these moguls and magnates that he was often photographed with. That was really Nancy's crowd. These two former cops, these blue collar guys, that was really the people. Those were the people that President Reagan loved to hang out with.
You know, Max Boot, I watched so many things about Reagan, but I'm fascinated with that televised speech he did. I think it's called A Time to Choose or A Time for Choosing. And you watch that and you say to yourself, what makes this guy tick? Because what I just watched was so profound. How does somebody come up with that? What made him tick on areas like that?
Well, his Time for Choosing speech, which was kind of his national political debut in the fall of 1964, this nationally televised speech in favor of Barry Goldwater, who was then the Republican nominee, it kind of took the country by storm. But the secret of that speech was that he had actually been preparing it for years. Not that he'd been consciously preparing it, but he'd been getting ready to give a speech like that for years, because in the 1950s, after his Hollywood career waned, he went to work for General Electric. He was host of General Electric Theater, one of only two people ever to host a national TV show before becoming president. But also as part of his job for GE was going out and giving speeches on behalf of the company. And he did that all the time, not just on corporate themes, but on political themes. And that's where he developed, you know, kind of his modus operandi, which is that he would write down arguments and facts on index cards. And then he would shuffle those index cards before every speech to create a fresh speech. And then he would judge the audience reaction. And he was a very keen, judge of what his audience liked and didn't like. And so if an index card resonated with the audience, it stayed in his speech. If it didn't resonate, it went to the trash can. And so he had been doing this for years. So by the time he gave the Time for Choosing speech in 1964, his speech was highly honed. He had been giving versions of it for years, so it didn't come out of nowhere. It took years of preparation to achieve that effect.
And you know, Max, you know, finally, we still hear his critics, and I know there are a lot of critics of trickle-down economics, and, you know, that'll be debated, and that's a good debate for society to have. But the way he dealt with foreign policy, there are always people that said, well, he was just an actor, he had a good support staff, but there was still, beyond all that, Max, his ability to connect with people, and the fact they called him the great communicator. I've always said that, to me, that's one of the most accurate brandings of a politician ever.
Yeah, that was he had a very keen appreciation for the performative aspect of the presidency, which is incredibly important. I mean, there was a funny line because he was asked one time, you know, how could an actor be president? And his reply was, I don't understand how anybody but an actor could be president, because you have to be giving a performance all the time. I mean, every word you say is minutely examined by the entire world. So you're kind of on stage 24/7. And that's something he was used to, having basically been on stage his whole life. So he really understood how to use the bully pulpit, how to communicate from the White House. And I think that was one of his most important achievements, was actually to lift America's spirits after the troubles of the 1970s, you know, the decade of Vietnam, Watergate, Iran hostage crisis, inflation, and all the rest of the gas lines. He really made Americans feel good about themselves in the 1980s, convinced them by 1984 that it was morning again in America. And I think that was, you can argue it was just psychological, but psychology really matters. And he really affected the nation's psyche.
The name of the book, Reagan, His Life and Legend, written by our guest, Max Boot, a 10-year project coming to fruition and getting universal praise from the left and the right. Max, good to have you on. Hopefully we can chat down the road, Max Boot. Max, thanks so much.
Thanks for your time.
Appreciate it. Max Boot there. So, folks, I've already ordered it. In fact, I got it as an audiobook the other day. Reagan, His Life and Legend.